committee, that you're leading the pro-testify forces in the Civil War going on in the White House? I didn't realize that.
No.
She wanders over to the wallpaper in the dining room, scenes of the Revolutionary War. Jackie Kennedy first put it up, a gift from a friend. Betty Ford didn't like it and took it down. President Carter put it back up. It's been up and down since. Rachel loved the wallpaper, so we put it back up. Have some coffee, Carrie. You're making me nervous. Good morning, Mr. President, says Jenny Brickman, my deputy chief of staff and senior political advisor. She ran my campaigns for governor and worked under Carolyn on my presidential run. She is petite in every way, with a mess of bleach blonde hair, a mouth like a truck driver. She is my smiling knife. She will go to war for me when I let her. She would not merely dissect my opponents. If I didn't rein her in, she would slice them open from chin to navel. She would rip them to pieces with all the restraint of a pit bull and slightly less charm. Carolyn, after my victory, turned to policy. She still keeps an eye on politics, but her bigger role now is to get my agenda through Congress and push my foreign policy. Jenny, on the other hand, just focuses on politics, on getting me reelected. And unfortunately, on worrying about whether I will even make it through my first term. Our caucus in the House is holding steady right now, she says, having conferred with our side of House leadership. They said they're eager to hear your side of the Algeria story. I can't suppress a smirk. It probably came out more like, tell him to get his head out of his ass and defend himself. Is that closer? Nearly a direct quote, sir. I'm not making it easy on my allies. They want to defend me, but my silence makes that nearly impossible. They deserve more, but I just can't give it to them yet. We'll have time for that, I say. We are under no illusions about the vote in the House. Lester has the majority, and his caucus is itching to push a button to impeach. If Lester calls for a vote on it, I'm toast. But a strong defense of the House will make it much more likely that we'll prevail in the Senate, where Lester's party has 55 votes but needs a supermajority of 67 for removal. If our caucus in the House holds together, it will be harder for our people in the Senate to defect. What we're hearing from our side in the Senate is similar, Jenny says. Leader Jacoby is trying to lock down a caucus position of presumptive support. Her words, the idea being that removal is an extreme remedy and we should know more before such important decisions can be made. But they're not willing to do anything more than keep an open mind right now. Nobody's rushing to my defense. You aren't giving them a reason to, sir. You're letting Rhodes kick you in the balls and not fighting back. What I kept hearing was, Algeria looks bad. Really? Really bad? He better have a good explanation. Okay. Well, that was enjoyable, Jenny. Next topic. If we could stay here for one more next topic, Jenny. You got your 10 minutes on impeachment, and I gave you an hour last night for that mock session. That's the end of impeachment talk for right now. I have other things on my mind. Now, is there anything else? Yes, sir, Carolyn interjects. The issues layout we were planning for the re-election, we should start it now with the issues we know the American people care about and support. The minimum wage, the assault weapons ban, and tuition credits. We need positive news to counter the negative. That will give us a counter-narrative that, in spite of all the political shenanigans, you're determined to move the country forward. Let them hold their Salem witch trial while you try to solve real problems for real people. He won't get drowned out in all this impeachment talk. Senator Jacoby doesn't think so, sir. They're begging for a good issue to start rallying around. I heard the same thing in the House, says Jenny. If you give them something to sink their teeth into, something they really care about, it will remind them how important it is to protect the presidency. They need a reminder, I say with a sigh. Frankly, sir, right now, yes, they do. I hold up my hands. Fine. Talk to me. Start with a minimum wage increase next week, says Carolyn. Then an assault weapons ban. Then tuition credits. An assault weapons ban has about as much chance of passing the House as a resolution to rename Reagan National Airport after me. Carolyn tucks in her lips. That's correct, sir. It won't pass. We both know she's not pushing for an assault weapons ban because we could pass it, at least in this Congress. She goes on. But you do believe in it, and you have the credibility to fight for it. Then when the opposition party kills it and the minimum wage hike, both of which most Americans support, you will show them for who they are and you'll jam up Senator Gordon. Lawrence Gordon, a 3-term senator from my side of the aisle who, like every senator, thinks he should be president. But, unlike most of them, he's willing to consider running against a sitting president from his own party. He's also on the wrong side of our party and our country on both these issues. He voted against a minimum wage hike, and he likes the Second Amendment, at least as the NRA defines it, better than the First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments combined. Jenny wants to take out his knees before he even considers lacing up his shoes. Gordon won't primary me. I say he doesn't have the balls. Nobody's watching the Algeria story more closely than Gordon, says Jenny. I look at Carolyn. Jenny has sharp political instincts, but Carolyn has instincts plus institutional knowledge of D.C. from her time in Congress. She's also the smartest person I've ever met. I'm not afraid of Gordon primarying you, says Carolyn. I'm afraid of him thinking about primarying you. Privately encouraging speculation, allowing himself to be courted, reading his name in the Times or on CNN. What's there to lose for him? It gives him a leg up down the road. He gets a nice ego stroke, too. Who's more popular than a challenger? He's like a backup quarterback. Everyone loves him while he's sitting on the sidelines. Gordon will get nothing but a nice vanity tour out of it, but meanwhile, your credibility is undercut every second it happens. He looks bright and shiny. You look weak. I nod. That all sounds right. I think we should float the minimum wage or the assault weapons ban, she says. We make Gordon come to us and ask us to sit on them. Then he owes us. And he knows if he screws us, we'll shove a legislative item or two up his keister. Remind me never to piss you off, Carolyn. The vice president is on board with this, says Jenny. Of course she is, Carolyn makes a face. She has a healthy suspicion of Kathy Brandt, who was my chief opponent for the nomination. She was the right choice for vice president, but that doesn't make her my closest ally. Either way, Kathy would make the same calculation in her own self-interest. If I'm removed from office, she becomes president, and she will almost immediately be running for election. She doesn't need Larry Gordon or anyone else getting any ideas. While I agree with your analysis of the problem, I say, I think your proposed solution is too cute, by half. I want to come out strong for both measures. But I won't back off for Gordon. We'll force the opposition's hand. It's the right thing to do, and win or lose, we'll be strong, and they'll be wrong. Jenny pipes up. That's the person I voted for, sir. I think you should do it, but I still don't think it will be enough. You are seen as really weak right now, and I don't think any domestic policy move can fix it. The phone call to Suleiman, the Algeria nightmare... You need a commander-in-chief moment, a rally around the leader No, I say, reading her mind. Jenny, I am not ordering a military strike just to look tough. There are any number of safe targets, Mr. President. It's not like I'm asking you to invade France. How about one of the drone targets in the Middle East, but instead of a drone, escalate it to a full aerial No. The answer is no. She puts her hands on her hips, shakes her head. Your wife was right. You really are a shitty politician. But she meant it as a compliment. Mr. President, can I be blunt? She says. You haven't been so far? She puts her hands out in front of her as if trying to frame the issue for me. Or maybe she's pleading with me. "You're going to be impeached," she says. "And if you don't do something to turn things around, something dramatic, the senators and your own party will jump ship. And I know you won't resign. It isn't in your DNA. Which means President Jonathan Lincoln Duncan will be remembered in history for one thing, and one thing only. You'll be the first president forcibly removed from office." Chapter 5. After talking with Ginny and Carolyn, I head across the hall into my bedroom where Deborah Lane is already opening her bag of goodies.
"Good morning, Mr. President," she says.
I pull down on my tie, unbutton my shirt. "Top of the morning, Doc." She focuses on me, appraises me, and doesn't look happy. I seem to have that effect on a lot of people these days.
"You forgot to shave again," she says.
"I'll shave later." It's actually 4 days running now that I haven't shaved. When I was in college at UNC, I had this superstitious routine. I didn't shave during finals week. It tended to shock people because though my hair on my head is probably best described as light brown, my facial hair doesn't follow script. Somehow, an orange pigment creeps in to give me a fiery auburn beard. And I can grow a beard fast. By the end of finals, everyone was calling me Paul Bunyan. I never thought about that after college. Until now.
"You look tired," she says. "How many hours did you sleep last night?"
"Two or three."
"That's not enough, Mr. President."
"I have a few balls in the air right now."
"But you won't be able to juggle that sleep."
She puts her stethoscope on my bare chest. Dr. Deborah Lane is not my official doctor, but a specialist in hematology at Georgetown. She grew up under apartheid in South Africa, but fled to the United States for high school and never left. Her close-cropped hair is now completely gray. Her eyes are probing, but kind. For the last week, she's come to the White House every day because it's easier and less conspicuous if a professional-looking woman, albeit one with a not-very-well-disguised medical bag, visits the White House as opposed to the president visiting MedStar Georgetown University Hospital on a daily basis. She puts the blood pressure wrap on my arm.
"Have you been feeling?" "I have a gigantic pain in my ass," I say. "Can you look and see if the Speaker of the House is up there?"
She shoots me a look, but doesn't laugh, not even a smirk.
"Physically, I say, I feel fine."
She shines a light inside my mouth. She looks closely at my torso, my abdomen, my arms and legs, turns me around, and does the same thing on my other side.
"Bruising is worsening," she says.
"I know. It used to look like a rash. Now it looks like someone has been pummeling the backs of my legs with hammers. In my first term as governor of North Carolina, I was diagnosed with a blood disorder known as immune thrombocytopenia, ITP, which basically means a low platelet count. My blood doesn't always clot as well as it should. I announced it publicly at the time and told the truth. Most of the time, the ITP isn't an issue. I was told to avoid activities that could lead to bleeding, which wasn't hard for a man in his 40s. My baseball days were long over, and I was never much for bullfighting or knife juggling. The disorder flared up twice during my time as governor, but left me alone during the campaign for the presidency. It reemerged when Rachel's cancer returned. My doctor is convinced that an overload of stress is a significant cause of relapse, but I treated it easily. It returned a week ago, when the bruising under the skin on my calves first started appearing. The rapid discoloration and spread of bruising tells both of us the same thing. This is the worst case I've had yet.
"Headaches?" Dr. Deb asks. "Dizziness? Fever?"
"No, no, and no."
"Fatigue?"
"From lack of sleep, sure."
"Nosebleeds?"
"No, ma'am."
"Blood in your teeth or gums?"
"Toothbrush is clean."
"Blood in your urine or stool?"
"No." It's hard to be humble when they play a song for you every time you enter the room, when the world financial markets hang on your every word, and when you command the world's greatest military arsenal. But if you need to knock yourself down a few pegs, try checking your stool for blood. She steps back and humps to herself. I'm going to draw blood again, she says. I was very concerned by your count yesterday. You were under 20,000. I don't know how you talked me out of hospitalizing you right then and there. I talked you out of it, I say, because I'm the President of the United States. I keep forgetting. I can do 20,000, Doc. The normal range for her platelets is between 150,000 and 450,000 per microliter, so nobody's throwing a parade for a count under 20,000, but it's still above the critical stage. You're taking your steroids? Religiously. She reaches into her bag, then gets to work, rubbing alcohol on my arm with a swab. I'm not looking forward to the blood draw because she's not great with needles. She's out of practice. At her high level of specialty, somebody else usually performs the rudimentary tasks. But I have to limit the number of people in this world who know about this. My ITP disorder may be public knowledge, but nobody needs to know how bad it is right now, especially right now. So she's a one-person show for the time being. Let's do a protein treatment, she says. What? Now? Yes, now. The last time I did that, I couldn't string a sentence together for a better part of a day. That's a non-starter, Doc. Not today. She stops, the swab in her hand trailing down to my knuckles. Then a steroid infusion. No, the pills mess with my head enough. Her head angles slightly as she considers a response. I'm not the usual patient, after all. Most patients do whatever their doctors tell them. Most patients are not leaders of the free world. She goes back to prepping my arm, frowning deeply, until she has the needle poised. Mr. President, she says in a tone I've heard my grade school teachers use, you can tell anyone else in the world what to do, but you can't order your body around. Doc, you're at risk of internal bleeding, she says, bleeding in the brain. You could have a stroke. Whatever it is you're dealing with, it can't be worth that risk. She looks me in the eye. I don't respond, which in itself is a response. It's something that bad, she whispers. She shakes her head, waves her hand. Don't. I know you can't tell me. Yes, it's something that bad. And the attack could come an hour from now or later today. It could have happened 20 seconds ago, and Carolyn could be rushing in to tell me about it right now. I can't be out of commission for even an hour, much less several. I can't risk it. It has to wait, I say. A couple of days, probably. A bit rattled by what she doesn't know, Deb just nods and plunges the needle into my arm. I'll double the steroids, I say, which means it will feel like I've drunk four beers instead of two. It's a line I have to straddle. I can't be out of commission. But I have to stay alive. She finishes in silence, packing away the blood draw in her bag and getting ready to leave. You have your job, and I have mine, she says. I'll get the labs back within 2 hours. But we both know your count is cratering. Yes, we do. She stops at the doorway and turns to me. You don't have a couple of days, Mr. President, she says. You might not even have one.
Chapter 6 Today, and only today, they will celebrate. He must give them that. His small team has worked day and night with purpose and devotion and with great success. Everyone needs a break. The wind off the river lifts his hair. He pulls on his cigarette, the orange tip glowing in the dim early evening air. He savors the view from the penthouse terrace overlooking the River Spray, the city bustling across the water, the East Side Gallery, the entertainment center. The Mercedes-Benz Arena is hosting a concert tonight. He doesn't recognize the group's name, but the muted sounds, audible even from across the river, tell him that the music involves heavy guitar and a thumping bass. This part of Berlin has changed considerably since he was last here. A mere 4 years ago. He turns back to look inside the penthouse, 160 square meters with 4 bedrooms and a designer open-plan kitchen where his team is laughing and gesturing, pouring champagne and probably already halfway drunk. The four of them, all geniuses in their own right, none of them over the age of 25, some of them probably still virgins. El Murod, his stomach hanging over his belt, his beard unkempt, wearing an insipid blue hat that reads, Vet, World War III. Mahmoud, already with his shirt off, showing off his decidedly unimpressive biceps in a mock bodybuilder pose. All four of them turn toward the door, and El Murod goes to answer it. When the door opens, eight women walk in, all wearing teased-up hair and skin-tight dresses, all with bodies of centerfolds, all paid princely sums to show his team the night of their lives. He steps carefully along the terrace, wary of the heat and pressure sensors, deactivated right now, of course, rigged to detonate the entire terrace should anything heavier than a bird land on it. It set him back nearly €1 million, these precautions. But what's €1 million when you're about to earn €100 million? One of the prostitutes, an Asian who can't be over 20, with boobs that can't be real, with a sudden interest in him that can't be sincere, approaches him as he walks back into the penthouse and slides the door shut. Wie lautet dein Name? She asks. What is your name? He smiles. She is just flirting, playing a part. She doesn't care what he tells her. But there are people who would pay anything or do anything to know the answer to her question. And just once, he'd like to let down his guard and answer the question truthfully. I am Suleiman Jindoruk, he'd like to say, and I'm about to reboot the world.
Chapter 7. I close the folder on my desk after reviewing the various items that my White House counsel, Danny Akers, and his staff have prepared for me in consultation with the Attorney General. A draft executive order declaring martial law throughout the nation and a legal memorandum exploring the constitutionality of doing so. Draft legislation for Congress and a draft executive order declaring the suspension of habeas corpus throughout the nation. An executive order instituting price controls and rationing of various consumer goods along with authorizing legislation where needed. I just pray that it doesn't come to this.
Mr. President, says Joanne, my secretary, the Speaker of the House.
Lester Rhodes smiles politely at Joanne and strides into the Oval Office, his hand outstretched. I'm already out from around my desk to greet him.
Good morning, Mr. President, he says, shaking my hand and sizing me up, probably wondering why I have the scruffy beginnings of a beard. Mr. Speaker, I say. Usually I follow up with a thanks for coming or good to see ya, but I can't summon pleasantries with this man. Rhodes, after all, was the architect of his party's reclamation of the House during midterm elections, based exclusively on the promise of taking our country back, and that ridiculous report card on my performance that he blew up for all the candidates, grading me on foreign policy, the economy, a number of hot-button issues with the tagline, Duncan is flunkin'. He takes the couch and I sit in the chair. He shoots his cuffs and settles in. He is dressed for the part of the powerful legislator. The slate blue shirt with white collar and cuffs, the bright red tie perfectly dimpled, all the colors of the flag represented. He still has the cocky glow of newly acquired power. He's only been speaker for 5 months. He doesn't realize his limitations yet. That makes him more dangerous, not less.
I ask myself why you invited me here, he goes on. You know, one of the storylines coming out of cable news is that we're cutting a deal, you and I. You agree not to seek re-election, and I call off the hearings.
I nod slowly. I heard that one, too.
But I told my aides, I said, go back and watch those videos of the POWs who were captured in Desert Storm along with Corporal John Duncan. See how scared they were. How scared they must have been to denounce their own country on camera. And then, after you see that, go ask what the Iraqis must have done to John Duncan for being the only American POW from that unit who refused to go on camera.
And after you wrapped your mind around that, I told them, ask yourself if John Duncan is the sort of fella who will back down from a fight with a bunch of congressmen.
Which means he still doesn't know why he's here. Lester, I say, do you know why I never talk about that, what happened to me in Iraq?
I don't, he says. Modesty, I suppose.
I shake my head. No one in this town is modest.
No.
The reason I don't talk about that is that some things are more important than politics. Most rank-and-file congressmen never need to learn that lesson. But in order for the government to function and for the good of the country, the Speaker of the House does. The sooner, the better. He opens his hand, signaling that he's ready for the punchline.
Lester, how many times have I failed to discuss covert operations with the Intelligence Committee since I've been president? Or if it was particularly sensitive, with the Gang of Eight?
The law says that I must make a finding before engaging in a covert action and must share that finding with the House and Senate Intelligence Committees in advance of the action, if possible. But if the matter is particularly sensitive, I can limit disclosure to the so-called Gang of Eight, the Speaker and House Minority Leader, the Senate Majority and Minority Leaders, and the chairs and ranking members of the two Intelligence Committees.
Mr. President, I've only been Speaker for a few months, but in that time, as far as I understand it, you have always complied with your disclosure commitment.
And your predecessor, I'm sure he told you that I always complied when he was Speaker as well.
That's my understanding, yes, he agrees, which is why it is so troublesome that not even the Gang of Eight heard one word about Algeria.
What's troublesome to me, Lester, is you don't realize that I must have a good reason why I'm not disclosing this time.
His jaw clenches, some color rising to his pale face.
Even after the fact, Mr. President, you're allowed to act first, disclose later if time is of the essence, but you're not even disclosing now. After that debacle in Algeria, after you allowed the monster to escape, you're breaking the law.
Ask yourself why, Lester. I sit back in my chair. Why would I do that? Knowing exactly how you'd react. Knowing that I'm handing you grounds for impeachment on a silver platter.
There can only be one answer, sir.
Oh, really? And what's that one answer, Lester?
Well, if I may speak freely.
Hey, it's just us kids here.
All right, then, he says with a sweeping nod. The answer is that you don't have a good explanation for what you did. You're trying to negotiate some truce with that bastard terrorist, and you stopped that militia group from killing him so you could keep negotiating whatever peace, love, and harmony deal you seem to think you could cut. And you almost got away with it. We never would have heard a word about Algeria. You'd have denied the whole thing.
He leans forward on his knees, looking me dead in the eye, his gaze so intense his eyes are almost watering.
But then that American boy got killed, and they got it on video for all the world to see. You got caught with your pants down, and still you won't tell us, because you don't want anyone to know what you're doing until it's signed, sealed, and delivered. He jabs a finger at me. Well, Congress will not be denied our oversight function on this. As long as I'm Speaker, no president will run off on his own and cut some deal with terrorists they'll never honor anyway and leave us looking like the weak stepchild. As long as...
That's enough, Lester.
I'm Speaker. This country will...
Enough. I get to my feet. After a moment, stunned, Lester stands as well.
Get this straight, I say. There are no cameras here. Don't pretend that you believe what you're saying. Don't pretend that you really think I wake up every morning whispering sweet nothings to terrorists. You and I both know that I'd take out that asshole right now if I thought it would serve the best interest of our nation. It's great political spin, Lester. I'll give you that. That garbage you're spewing about me wanting to make love, not war, with the Sons of Jihad. But do not walk into the Oval Office and pretend for one second that you actually believe it.
He blinks his eyes. Out of his element here. He's not accustomed these days to someone raising his voice to him, but he remains silent because he knows I'm right. I'm doing you all kinds of favors here, Lester. I'm aiding and abetting you by remaining silent. Every second I say nothing, you get more fuel on your fire. You're beating the ever-loving crap out of me in public, and I'm sitting there saying, thank you, sir, may I have another? Surely you are smart enough to realize that if I'm going to violate every political instinct I possess and remain mute, there must be a pretty damn important reason why I'm doing that. There must be something vitally important at stake. Lester holds his stare for as long as he can. Then his gaze drops down to the floor. He stuffs his hands in his pockets and he rocks on his heels.
Then tell me, he says. Not intelligence, not the Gang of Eight, me. If it's as important as you say, tell me what it is.
Lester Rhodes is the absolute last person to whom I would give all the details, but I can't let him know I think that. I can't, Lester. I can't. I'm asking you to trust me. There was a time when that statement from a president to a House Speaker would be enough. Those days are long in the rearview mirror. I can't agree to that, Mr. President. An interesting word choice, can't, not won't. Lester is under so much pressure from his caucus, especially the fire breathers who react to every soundbite on social media and talk radio, ginning up this whole thing. Whether it's true or not, whether he believes it or not, they've now created a caricature of me, and Speaker Lester Rhodes cannot let it be known that he decided to trust that caricature during this important moment. Think about the cyber attack in Toronto, I say. The Sons of Jihad hasn't claimed responsibility for it. Think about that. Those guys always claim responsibility. Every attack they've ever done has come with a message to the West to stay away from their part of the world, Central and Southeastern Europe. Get our money out, get our troops out, but not this time. Why, Lester?
You could tell me why, he says.
I motion for him to sit down. And I do the same. Your ears only, I say. Yes, sir. The answer is, we don't know why. But my guess? Toronto was a test run. Proof that he had the goods. Probably to get his down payment for his real job. I sit back and let that settle in. Lester has the sheepish look of a kid who realizes he's supposed to understand something, but doesn't, and doesn't want to admit it. Then why not kill him? Lester asks. Why rescue him from that attack in Algeria? I stare at Lester. My ears only, he says. I can't give Lester all the details, but I can give him enough to nibble on. We weren't trying to rescue Suleiman, Jindorik, I say. We were trying to capture him. Then, Lester opens his hands, why did you stop that militia group? They didn't want to capture him, Lester. They wanted to kill him. They were going to fire shoulder-launched missiles into his house. So, Lester shrugs, a captured terrorist, a dead terrorist, what's the difference? In this case, a huge difference, I say. I need Suleiman Jindorik, alive. Lester looks at his hands, twists his wedding ring, staying in listen mode, revealing nothing on his end. Our intel told us this militia group had found him. We didn't know more than that. All we could do was piggyback their operation in Algeria, try to stop them from a full-on attack, and catch Suleiman ourselves. We stopped their attack, but Suleiman got away in the melee. And yes, an American died. Something we wanted to remain covert and highly classified became viral on social media within hours. Lester works that over, his eyes narrowed, head nodding. I don't think Suleiman is working alone, I say. I think he was hired. And I think Toronto was the warm-up, the trial run, the appetizer.
And we are the main course, Lester whispers.
Correct. A cyber attack, he mumbles. Bigger than Toronto.
Big enough to make Toronto look like a stub toe.
Christ.
I need Suleiman alive because he may be the only person who could stop it. And he can identify who hired him and who else, if anyone, is working with him. But I don't want anyone to know what I know or what I think. I'm trying to do something that is incredibly difficult for the United States of America to do. Fly under the radar. A hint of realization comes to the speaker's expression. He leans back against the couch like a man who's holding all the cards.
You're saying our hearings will interfere with what you're doing?
Without a doubt.
Then why did you agree to testify in the first place?
To buy time, I say. You wanted to haul my entire national security team before your committee earlier this week. I couldn't have that. I offered myself up in exchange for the time extension.
But now you need even more time. Beyond next Monday.
Yes.
And you want me to go back to my caucus and tell them we should give it to you.
Yes.
But I can't tell them why. I can't tell them any of what you told me. I just have to tell them that I decided to trust you.
You're their leader, Lester. So lead. Tell them you've decided that it's in the best interest of our nation that we temporarily hold off on the hearings. His head drops and he rubs his hands together, warming up for the speech that he probably recited into a mirror a dozen times before coming over here.
Mr. President, he says, I understand these hearings are not something you want us to do. But just as you have your responsibilities, we have an oversight responsibility that serves as a check on executive power. I have members who elected me to ensure that we serve as that check. I can't go back to my caucus and tell them we are going to shirk our responsibility.
It was never going to matter what I said to him today. He's got a playbook, and he's following it. Patriotism was never going to factor in. If this guy ever had an unselfish thought, as my mama would say, it would die of loneliness. But I'm not done trying. If this goes well, I say, and we stop this terrorist attack, you will be standing right next to me. I will tell the world that the speaker put aside partisan differences and did the right thing for his country. I will hold you up as an example of what is right in Washington, D.C. You'll be speaker for life.
He continues to nod, clears his throat. His foot on the floor has begun to tap.
But if...
He can't bring himself to finish the sentence. If things go wrong, then I'll take the blame. All of it.
But I will be blamed too, he says, because I stopped those hearings without giving my members or the public any reason at all. You can't promise me that I'll come out of this unscathed.
Lester, this is the job you signed up for. Whether you knew it or not, whether you like it or not, you're right. There are no promises here. No sure things. I am the commander-in-chief, looking you in the eye and telling you that the security of this country is in jeopardy and I need your help. Are you going to help me or not? It doesn't take him long. He works his jaw, looks at his hands.
Mr. President, I'd like to help you, but you have to understand, we have a response. Damn it, Lester, put your country first. I push myself out of my chair too fast, feeling wobbly, the anger consuming me. I'm wasting my breath.
Lester rises from the couch, shoots his cuffs again, straightens his tie.
So we'll be seeing you on Monday.
As if nothing I said remotely registered with him. The only thing he cares about is returning to his caucus and telling them he stood up to me.
You think you know what you're doing, I say. But you don't have the slightest idea.
Chapter 8. I stare at the door after Speaker Rhodes leaves. I'm not sure what I expected of him.
Old-fashioned patriotism, a sense of responsibility, maybe, a bit of trust in the president. Dream on. There is no trust anymore. In the current environment, there's no gain in it. All the incentives push people in the opposite directions. So Rhodes will go to his corner, leading a charge he can't really control because his caucus twitches at each tweet. Some days, my side isn't much better. Participation in our democracy seems to be driven by the instant gratification worlds of Twitter, Snapchat, Facebook, and the 24-hour news cycle. We're using modern technology to revert to primitive kinds of human relations. The media knows what sells, conflict, and division. It's also quick and easy. All too often, anger works better than answers. Resentment better than reason. Emotion trumps evidence. A sanctimonious sneering one-liner, no matter how bogus, is seen as straight talk, while a calm, well-argued response is seen as canned and phony. It reminds me of the old political joke. Why do you take such an instant dislike to people? It saves a lot of time. What happened to factual, down-the-middle reporting? That's hard to even define anymore as the line between fact and fiction, between truth and lies, gets murkier every day. We can't survive without a free press, dedicated to preserving that fine line and secure enough to follow the facts where they lead. But the current environment imposes serious pressures on our journalists, at least those who cover politics, to do just the reverse. To exercise their own power and to, in the words of one wise columnist, abnormalize all politicians, even honest, able ones, often because of relatively insignificant issues. Scholars call this false equivalency. It means that when you find a mountain to expose in one person or party, you have to pick a molehill on the other side and make it into a mountain to avoid being accused of bias. The built-up molehills also have large benefits. Increased coverage on the evening news, millions of retweets, and more talk show fodder. When the mountains and molehills all look the same, campaigns and governments devote too little time and energy debating the issues that matter most to our people. Even when we try to do that, we're often drowned out by the passion of the day. There's a real cost to this. It breeds more frustration, polarization, paralysis, bad decisions, and missed opportunities. But with no incentive to actually accomplish something, more and more politicians just go with the flow, fanning the flames of anger and resentment when they should be acting as the fire brigade. Everybody knows it's wrong, but the immediate rewards are so great, we stagger on, just assuming that our Constitution, our public institutions, and the rule of law can endure each new assault without doing permanent damage to our freedoms and way of life. I ran for president to change that vicious cycle. I hope I still can. But right now, I have to deal with the wolf at the door. Joanne walks in and says,
"Danny and Alex are here."
Joanne used to work for the governor I succeeded in North Carolina. As he was leaving office and I was on my way in, she ran the transition with an efficiency that impressed me. Everyone was afraid of her. I was told not to hire her because she came from them, the opposing political party. But Joanne told me, "Mr. Governor-elect, I just got divorced. I have two kids in middle school and I'm broke. I'm never late. I'm never sick. I can type faster than you can spit, and if you're acting like a donkey's ass, I'll be the first to let you know it." She's been with me ever since. Her oldest just started in the Treasury Department. "Mr. President," says Danny Akers, White House counsel. Danny and I were next-door neighbors in Wilkes County, North Carolina. Growing up in a tiny town all of 1 square mile in area, nestled between a highway and a single traffic signal. We swam and fished and skateboarded and played ball and hunted together. We taught each other how to knot a tie and jumpstart a car and string a pole and throw a breaking ball. We went through everything together, grade school through college at UNC.
We even enlisted together, joining the Rangers as E4s after college. The only thing we didn't experience together was Desert Storm. Danny wasn't assigned to Bravo Company, as I was, so he never saw action in Iraq. While I was trying, unsuccessfully, to overcome my injuries from Desert Storm and play pro ball in AA in Memphis, Danny was starting law school at UNC. He was the one who vouched for me to Rachel Carson, a 3L when I entered UNC Law. "Mr. President," Alex Trimble, the barrel chest and buzz cut practically scream out Secret Service when you first look at him. He's not exactly a laugh a minute, but he's as straight and strong as they come, and he runs my security detail as efficiently as a military operation. "Sit, sit." I should go back to my desk, but I sit on the couch. "Mr. President," says Danny, "my memorandum on Title 18, Section 3056. He hands me the document. "You want the long or the short version?" he asked, knowing the answer already. "Short. The last thing I feel like doing is reading legal speak right now. I have no doubt the memo was prepared with precision. I always loved the battlefield of the courtroom as a prosecutor. But Danny was the scholar, combing over new Supreme Court opinions for fun, debating fine points of law, and prizing the written word. He left his law firm to be my counsel when I was governor of North Carolina. He was great at it until the then president nominated him to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. He loved that job and could have held it happily for life had I not been elected president and asked him to join me again. "Just tell me what I can and can't do," I say. Danny winks at me. "The statute says you can't decline protection, but there is precedent for temporarily refusing it as part of your right to personal privacy." Alex Trimble is already leveling a stare at me. I've previously broached this topic with him, so this isn't coming completely out of the blue, but he was obviously hoping Danny would talk me out of it. "Mr. President," Alex says, "with all due respect, you can't be serious." "Serious is a heart attack." "Now of all time, sir, it's decided," I say. "We can do a loose perimeter," he says, "or at least some advance work." "No." Alex clutches the arms of his chair, his mouth slightly agape. "I need a minute with my White House counsel," I say to him. "Mr. President, please don't, Alex," I say. "I need a minute with Danny." With a heavy sigh and a shake of the head, Alex leaves us. Danny looks back at the door to ensure we're alone, then he looks at me. "Son, you've gone crazier than a March hare," he says, a hint of the old twang in his voice as he invokes my mama's favorite saying. He knows them all as well as I do. Danny's parents were good, hard-working people, but they were away from home a lot. His dad put in a lot of overtime for a trucking company, and his mom worked the night shift at the local plant. My father was a high school math teacher who died in a car crash when I was 4. So when I was a kid, we lived on a grade school teacher's partial pension and what Mama earned waiting tables at Curly Ray's by Miller's Creek. But she was always home at night, so she helped the Akerses out with Danny. She loved him like a second son. He spent as much time at our house as his own. Normally, when he triggers those memories, it brings a smile to my face. Instead, I lean forward and rub my hands together. "Okay. You want to tell me what's going on?" he tries. "You're starting to freak me out." "Join the club." I feel my guard slowly lowering, being alone with Danny. In this job, he and Rachel were always my ports in a storm. I look up at him. "We are a long way from catching brookies at Garden Creek," I say. "Good, because you could never cast a line to save your life anyway." Again, I don't smile. "You're right where you're supposed to be, Mr. President," he says. "If the shit's hitting the fan, you're the guy I want in charge." I let out air, nod my head. "Hey," Danny gets up from his chair and sits down next to me on the couch. He lightly punches my knee. "Being in charge isn't being alone. I'm right here. Same place I've always been, no matter what your title is. Same place I always be." "Yeah, I know. I look at him. I know that.
This isn't about the impeachment bullshit, is it? Because that'll work itself out. Lester Rhodes? That boy's so dumb he couldn't pour piss out of a boot if the directions were on the bottom.
He's pulling out all the stops, dusting off another of Mama Lil's greatest hits. He's trying to take me back to her strength. After Daddy died, she cracked the whip as hard as any drill sergeant I'd let her meet, smacking me in the head if she heard a double negative or an ain't, telling me I'd go to college or she'd tan my hide. She'd go to work early and come home in the afternoon with two styrofoam cartons of food. That would be dinner for Danny and me. I'd rub her feet while she checked her homework and interrogated us about our day at school. She always said, "You boys aren't rich enough to afford not to pay attention."
"It's that other thing, isn't it?" said Danny. "The thing that you can't tell me, that's had you canceling half your schedule for the last 2 weeks? The reason that you've suddenly become so interested in martial law and habeas corpus and price controls? Whatever it is that keeps you as quiet as fallen snow about Suleiman Jindoric in Algeria while Lester Rhodes beats the snot out of you?"
"Yeah," I say, "it's that thing."
"Yeah."
Danny clears his throat, grums his fingers.
"Scale of 1 to 10, he says. "How bad?"
"1,000.
"Jesus. And you have to go off leash. I gotta tell you, that sounds like a terrible idea."
"It just might be, but it's the best one I have."
"You're scared," he says.
"Yeah. Yeah, I am." We are quiet for a long moment.
"You know when the last time I saw you this scared?"
"When Ohio put me over 270 electoral votes."
"No."
"When I found out Bravo Company was deploying."
"No, sir."
I look at him.
"When we were getting off that bus at Fort Benning," he says, "and Sergeant Melton was calling out, 'Where are the fours? Where are the goddamn frat boy maggots?' We weren't off that damn bus yet, and the sergeant was already sharpening his knives for the college boys, who got to start at a higher pay and rank."
I chuckle. "I remember."
"Yeah. Never forget your first smoke session, right?"
"I saw the look on your face when we were walking down the aisle of that bus. It is probably the same as the look on mine, scared as a mouse in a snake pit."
"Do you remember what you did?"
"Pissed my pants."
Danny turns and looks at me squarely. "You don't remember, do you, Ranger?"
"I swear I don't."
"You stepped in front of me," he says.
"I did."
"You sure as hell did. I'd been in the aisle seat, and you were by the window. So I was in front of you in the aisle. But the moment the sergeant started going off about the E4s, you elbowed your way in front of me so you'd be the first one off the bus to face him, not me. Scared as you were, that was your first instinct, to look out for me."
"Huh. I don't remember that."
Danny pats my leg. "So go ahead, be scared, President Duncan," he says. "You're still the one I want protecting us."
Chapter 9. As the sun warms her face, as her earbuds fill her with the music of Wilhelm Friedemann Herzog performing the full set of Johann Sebastian's sonatas and partitas for solo violin, Bach decides that there are worse ways to spend time than sightseeing at the National Mall. The Lincoln Memorial, with its Greek columns and imposing marble statue perched atop a seemingly endless staircase, is inappropriately magisterial, better suited for a deity than a president revered for his humility. But that contradiction is quintessentially American, typical of a nation that was built on the premise of freedom, liberty, and individual rights, but that tramples freely on those principles abroad. These thoughts pass only as observations. Geopolitical policy is not what drives her. And like the country itself, this memorial, for all its irony, is no less magnificent. The reflecting pool, shimmering in the mid-morning sun. The veterans' memorials, especially the Korean War Memorial, move her in a way she hadn't expected. But her favorite attraction was the one she visited earlier this morning, Ford's Theater, the site of the most daring presidential assassination in the nation's history. It is bright enough outside to force one to squint, which makes her oversized sunglasses unnatural. She puts to good use the camera around her neck, making sure to capture multiple shots of everything. The Washington Monument, close-ups of Abe and FDR and Eleanor, inscriptions at the veterans' memorials. To cover herself in the unlikely event that anyone should happen to inquire how Isabella Mercado, the name on her passport, spent her day. In her earbuds now are the soulful cries of the chorus, the dancing violins of the St. John Passion, the dramatic confrontation between Pilate and Christ and the masses. Veg, vegmitim, kreuzica in. Away, away with him. Crucify him. She closes her eyes, as she often does, losing herself in the music, imagining herself sitting inside the St. Nicholas Church in Leipzig when the Passion was first played in 1724, wondering how the composer must have felt hearing his work come to life, observing its beauty wash over the congregants. She was born in the wrong century. When she opens her eyes, she sees a woman sitting on a bench nursing her child. A flutter passes through her. She removes her earbuds and watches this woman, looking down as her infant feeds from her, a soft smile on the mother's face. That, Bach knows, is what they mean when they say love. She remembers love. She remembers her mother, the feeling of her more than a visual image, though the latter is buoyed by the two photographs she managed to escape with. She remembers her brother more clearly, though unfortunately it's hard to remember anything but the scowl on his face, the look of pure hatred in his eyes the last time they saw each other. He has a wife and two daughters now. He is happy, she thinks. He has love, she hopes. She pops another ginger candy in her mouth and hails a cab. M Street Southwest and Capitol Street Southwest, she says, probably sounding like a tourist, but that works just fine. She stifles the nausea brought on by the greasy smell and the jerky movements of the cab. She puts her earbuds back in to prevent conversation with the chatty African driver. She pays in cash and breathes in fresh air for a few moments before proceeding to the restaurant. A pub, it's called, serving all manner of slaughtered animals on massive plates with an assortment of fried vegetables. She is invited to try our nachos, which, from what she can tell, consist of a plate of fried tortillas and processed cheese, a few token vegetables, and more meat from more slaughtered animals. She doesn't eat animals. She wouldn't kill an animal. Animals never did anything to deserve it. She sits on a stool fronting the window at a ledge intended for single customers, looking out over the street. Massive vehicles lined up at a traffic light, scrolling advertisements on billboards for various beers and fast food and auto loans and clothing stores and movies. The streets are crowded with people. The restaurant is not. It is just now 11 in the morning, so the lunch rush, as they call it, has not yet begun. The menu offers almost nothing she could stomach. She orders a soft drink and soup and waits. Overhead, clouds the color of ash have begun to appear throughout the sky. The newspaper said there is a 30% chance of rain, which means there is a 70% chance that she will complete her assignment tonight. A man takes the seat next to her left. She does not look at him. Face forward, her eyes glance only at the counter, waiting for the crossword puzzle to show. A moment later, the man slaps down the newspaper, folded open to the crossword, and enters letters into the squares on the top horizontal line of the puzzle. The letters say, "Confirmed." Looking down at her map of the National Mall, she uses a ballpoint pen to write in the white space on top, "Freight elevator." The man, pretending to be considering another clue, taps his pencil on the word he already wrote. The waiter arrives with her soft drink. She takes a long sip and savors the carbonation's settling effect on her roiling stomach. She writes, "Backup?" He taps the same word again, confirming once more. Then, in a down column on the puzzle, he writes, "You have ID." "I have it," she writes. She adds, "If it rains, meet it."